This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who's internationally known for his activism in the civil rights and peace movements. Coffin spent 18 years as the chaplain at Yale University, where he urged students to use their education for larger social causes than their own prosperity and security. During this period, he also led many demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, which kept him at odds with the university administration. In an effort to organize the religious community against the war, he co-founded the group Clergy and Laity Concerned. Coffin left Yale in 1976 and 1.5 years later became the senior minister at New York's Riverside Church, which has a long history of community activism. The church has an interracial congregation and welcomes gays and lesbians. It runs a men's shelter and food pantry, operates a program teaching English to immigrants, and is active in the sanctuary movement. Reverend William Sloan Coffin is the author of several books, including his latest, Living the Truth in a World of Illusions, published by Harper & Row. I asked Coffin why, after serving in World War II, then working briefly with the CIA, he was drawn to the religious life.
Well, I think the main thing is to have the religious questions. And World War II certainly raised some very deep questions about the inhumanity of human beings to other human beings, seeing what the Nazis did to the Jews, and also seeing men fall on grenades there was no time to throw back. So when I went to college afterwards, I knew what the important questions were, and the people who wrestled with them were either good atheists, like Sartre and Camus in France at that time, or deeply religious people like Niebuhr's and Paul Tillich, people like that.
Well, you spent 18 years as the minister at Yale, the chaplain at Yale. Did you want to be on a college campus?
Yes, very much. Now, I was very, very happy at Yale. Students were aroused in the 60s when I was there, late 50s, right up to the middle of the 70s. It got boring after a while. I mean, then security consciousness began to take over the campus. And I guess it's fair to say that every country's education reflects that country's ideology. So that if you go to a place like Cuba, you'll find students are cutting cane as well as studying, and doctors are out in the countryside as well as in the city, but they have a civil liberties problem. In our country, because our education reflects our ideology, the freedom of faculty and students to say pretty much what they will is vastly exalted over any obligation to do any good to anyone. And when I was at Yale, my job was to make people feel some kind of obligation to do some kind of good to some people who needed what they had to offer. And that was good. Now I feel that campuses are pretty dead morally, you know. They're exciting perhaps intellectually, but they're not exciting morally, and therefore not that exciting to me, at least.
Well, Yale's in many respects a very establishment-oriented college. Mm-hmm. Were you criticized by the administration for rocking the boat when you were there?
Well, we had a very tiffy relationship, Kingman Brewster and I, the president, but he came to all the funerals, and he came to church regularly on Sunday, and he saw me performing weddings and doing the baptisms, and knew that when there was a student in real trouble, I was the first fellow there. And so he knew that I was a good pastor. And I've always felt that any minister who's a really good pastor, who convinces people that he or she really cares about them, from the pulpit can say pretty much what he or she wills.
You were very active in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, and you've written that you were disturbed that the new left was a largely agnostic movement. What concerned you about that, and what struck you as being agnostic about it?
Well, it was not only that they didn't believe in God. That never bothers me quite so much, because I think the really important question is, in whom does God believe? And I think God believes in a lot of people who say they don't believe in God. If faith is being grasped by the power of love, then there are obviously a lot of people responding to God, even though they may not say, I believe in God. So it wasn't agnostic so much in the sense that people didn't believe in God. But there's a lot of bitterness. Lord Acton once said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power absolutely. He could have gone on to say, and by the way, powerlessness also corrupts, and absolute powerlessness absolutely. That is, people who are opposing the government and feel they're getting no place tend toward bitterness, tend toward hatred. They fight national self, national righteousness with personal self-righteousness, and they become, well, let me put it this way. It seems to me that if you love the good, you have to hate evil, or you're sentimental. But if you hate evil more than you love the good, you end up a damn good hater. And unfortunately, in the peace movement, there are good haters. I'm not saying the majority by any matter of means, and I certainly understand how people become embittered and get that way, but it's always sad to see that happen.
Where did you draw the line yourself as far as tactics? Because there were, especially on college campuses, there were many students who were taking over buildings and trashing certain records, even destroying certain buildings that were funded by the Defense Department doing war-related research. So what were your moral lines then about what you thought was an appropriate action to try to stop the war?
Well, my question would always be, is this going to stop the war? Is this going to be effective? Are you doing this to make yourself feel better? Or are you doing this to improve the situation? One has to avoid the politics of self-indulgence, self-pity, which isn't always easy when you get in these situations. On the violent side, I would feel the same way I do today about violence of students in South Africa. You don't have to condone it, but you cannot condemn it without pointing at what produced it. And the important thing is always to try to focus people's attention on the causes of this, which, again, was very hard during the war in Vietnam, that it was the war that was causing this. Actually, in the United States, there was very, very little violence in reaction to the violence in Vietnam. It was the movement was pretty nonviolent.
You were at Yale for 18 years. Why did you leave?
I said when I left that if you want to grow, you have to relinquish your proficiencies. I was pretty good at being chaplain. I knew all the ropes, you know. I knew all the people, knew what to do about what, and I was pretty good in my relationship with students. But I figured I'd done that. And so I just quit sort of cold. I didn't know what I was going to do next. And I think that's a good idea. One takes a job in this world. One doesn't take the job and stay with it through thick and thin necessarily.
When you moved to the Riverside Church in New York, did you find the kind of sermons that you would deliver change a lot? Because it was a city and you had a cross-generational population there. It wasn't just students.
That's
really
interesting. You should ask. Somebody else, a reporter, asked me that after I arrived there, and I was caught completely off guard because I hadn't thought about it. And then when I did, I realized, no, I hadn't. I really hadn't changed style of preaching at all. I was a little less. I never liked abstract concepts very much. Anyhow, they don't do terribly well in a sermon. So, and I never see sermons as lectures. They are emotionally powerful. They should be inspiring as well as educating. And so I've kept very much, the subjects can change, but that can change with the agenda, you know, that people have in the city. You do have to deal a lot more with unemployment. Who tells you who you are, God or your unemployment? That's a very real religious crisis, unemployment. And the question of money, people have money and money's bidding for their hearts a lot more when they're out working than when they're students, for instance. So emphases can change.
Do you think that there's a religious resurgence now?
Yes, but it's not a religious resurgence isn't always a good thing. That may sound like a funny thing for a reverend to say. But, it's like there are no atheists in foxholes. If that means that you're living at a profound level because you're in a foxhole or because you're experiencing the fragility of human life, that's a good thing. But if it simply means you're suspicious as hell and you better start believing in order to save your life, And that's not good. And if a lot of people are going back to church to save their souls, not to transcend themselves, then it's not necessarily a good thing. And if they're coming back because we live in an age of enormous uncertainty and they want simple certainties of the kind that fundamentalists are apt to give, then I can't say that that's necessarily a good thing. My view of the faith is it should make it possible for you to live with uncertainty. It shouldn't provide certainty. It should make it possible for you, because a mighty fortress is your God, to live with temporal insecurity of every kind.
You've written that you see this conflict going on now between authoritarian and humanitarian Christianity. Would you explain that?
Well, there are those, I think, who turn to religion, and this isn't only Christianity. You'll find fundamentalist Jews in Israel, and in Iran you'll find fundamentalist Muslims who are looking basically for law and order. And they tend to see religion in terms of rules and regulations, in terms of dogma. My feeling is that, as St. Augustine once said, love God and do what you like, which is not license, but freedom. It's a little, rules and regulations are a little bit like the stick that holds up the tomato vine. Without the stick, the vine couldn't get off the ground. But it's a combination of sun and soil that strengthens, nourishes the tomato vine. And there's no life coming out of that stick. And I think it's the same way with rules and regulations. They are penultimate. They're not ultimate. They point beyond themselves. Don't look at us. Use us to get beyond ourselves. And that the integrity of love is much more important than the purity of dogma. So to me, a true believer is one whose heart is overflowing with compassion and love for others, and who feels that rules and regulations are important but not ultimately important. And one other thing I'd say is you'll find that people who are really law and order Christians are more impressed with God's power than they are with God's love.
Do you feel like the fundamentalists who preach a more rule and regulation-oriented religion are, in a sense, your opponents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they differ. It's a different interpretation. I mean, if they think this is it, the Bible says this, or the Quran says this, fundamentalists who just find all the answers, you know, and simple certainties of this kind, you can't say that you believe life should be conducted in that fashion either. I mean, the cruelty that fundamentalists, as a rule, show to homosexuals is to me quite abhorrent. I also think they're very ignorant. I know the Bible as well as they do, and I've done as much scholarship on what these passages mean, and I know perfectly well that the Bible as a whole is certainly not pro-homosexuality, no question about that. But it never deals with long-term loving relationships between people of the same sex, for instance. That's not in the Bible. Now, when patently you see examples of that before you, and you know people who are enjoying that kind of relationship, you have to ask, well, what's going on here? Maybe there's more to be learned than what's found in one or two biblical passages. So in that sense, I guess we are opponents.
Well, does that depress you that a lot of what you would consider to be evil in this world has been done in the name of religion? I mean,
sure,
can you reconcile that?
Well, no, I can't reconcile it, but I can understand it, I think. I mean, what makes a person evil is not doing something evil. It's disguising the evil, pretending it's not evil. And if the essence of evil is disguise, what better disguise in this world than religious piety? So where else would you be looking for some evil people if not in the church? I mean, that's realism, I think. And you see that among the segregationists in South Africa, as you saw it among segregationists here. They thought they were doing God's will, you know, disguising their evil in religious piety. So, no, it's terrible. The churches have backed every evil in the world. But if you look at atheist societies like Nazism, Soviet communism, you realize that people are capable of doing plenty of evil without any church being around. And so the evil is a deeply human problem rather than essentially a religious problem. But just because we're in the church doesn't mean we're at best, forgiven sinners.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who's senior minister at the Riverside Church in New York. He's written several books, and his latest is titled Living the Truth in a World of Illusions. You have presided over, I'm sure, many, many, many ceremonies, weddings and and funerals and births and so on and so on. Those are times when people tend to really turn towards their religion, I think, those periods of ceremony or periods of loss. Is that an important time for you as a minister in that respect, because people are maybe more open at points like that in their lives?
This may surprise you or some of your listeners, but I would much rather not be known for being a social activist, as the happiest moments in my life are not in that area. They're much more in the intimate settings. They're moments when you're doing marriage counseling or when you're comforting people who have suffered loss, because those are the moments when human beings tend to be most human. People, when they're about to get married or are deeply in love, they're in a position to understand that our value is finally a gift and not an achievement, that love doesn't seek value but creates it. The expression's walking on air, a terrific expression. You don't climb up on air, you're levitated there by somebody else's love, right? Or I'm on cloud nine. It's a terrific expression, you know, because you didn't make it on your own. Grace did. Somebody else's love. Somebody did for you what you couldn't do for yourself. So those are wonderful moments for people to appreciate these most profound truths about life. And the same thing is true when you're suffering loss. I lost my own son 2 years ago in a terrible accident. But since then, I've been in a position to help people who have lost their own children as I wasn't before. I know exactly what they're going through. I know the feeling the world has nothing to give like that which it takes away. I know the anger and resentment they feel, the unfairness, you know. And I can stick with it. I don't protest it, you know. I says, go ahead, you know, fight it. Tears are absolutely important and all the rest of it. And then people gradually work their way out of their grief. They begin to realize, well, grief isn't perhaps the best way to hold this person close. And so you're with people when they are most vulnerable, and that's always the most satisfying part of the ministry. Baptism would be a little bit the same way. If they're being personally baptized, it would be very much the same way. And if they're baptizing a child, it's a very important moment.
After a loss, after the death of someone close to you, so many people, I think, go through either feeling that the religion has been renewed because they're relying so much on the religion, but on the other hand, a lot of people turn away from it and think that, you know, that any sense of God that they had was shattered by the unfairness of this terrible loss that they've suffered. And I mean, how can you console?
Well, first of all, people have some very goofy ideas about how the will of God operates. I can remember when our boys in Lebanon were blown up, you remember, in that terrible accident, 269, was it? And on television, night after night, for about a week, I guess, mothers and wives were pictured, and through their tears, many of them said, well, I guess it was the will of God. As if it was God's will that anybody be shot in this world, as if it's the will of God that anybody blow up anybody in this world, you know? It is never. People seem to think God goes around the world with his finger on triggers, his hands on steering wheels, with knives, his fists around knives, you know? So they always say, how did God let it happen? Well, my son was behind the wheel. God wasn't behind the wheel. My consolation came in feeling that the moment the waves came over Alex's car, God's heart was the first of all our hearts to break. That's what gave me comfort. I knew God was heartbroken over this dumb, stupid, tragic accident. And that's the way God feels about every loss in this world. Now, there are some mysterious things, such as cancer, that we still don't understand, you know, or worse yet, retarded children, you know, that's nobody's fault. Those are things we don't know much about. But if we don't know, then let's not pretend we do. And it's better to trust where you can't understand. And never forget all the unmerited good there is in this world. I mean, what did you and I ever do to enjoy a day like the day outside today? It is sensational. Sensational. I didn't earn it. So when we have unmerited evil, let's constantly remember the unmerited good. But I think for Christians to understand that you can always take your wounds to the wounded Lord and know that Christ will understand you, God will understand you, Jews have the same understanding of this, then you find legitimate comfort. Legitimate comfort. God is not in the event. God is in the response to the event.
Do you think that by saying, well, God must have wanted it if these boys were killed or whatever it is to, in a way, relieve yourself of responsibility for your own actions?
Well, sometimes, though I don't think, you know, when it came to Marines being killed over there, you can't hold the parents responsible for the fact that a dumb decision was made to expose them that way by moving out of neutrality and taking part in the intervention in Lebanon. But I think the basic understanding that is hard for people is that we really do have free will. And free will, that's, you have to have freedom if you're going to, if love is going to be the name of the game. And if we're free, then we're free to do bad as well as free to do good things. Free to be selfish, free to be generous. And to blame God for what people do with their freedom is not fair, except in the same way that you might say to a child, if you saw a child smash an expensive watch, it was your fault for giving the kid the watch in the first place. Now, you can blame God for giving us human freedom. Maybe we are not ready for it. We can't handle it. But it seems to me that's about where the blame stops.
You've done a lot of marriages. What do you think of interfaith marriage between Catholics and Protestants or Christians and Jews?
I think that it can work in two instances. If their religion doesn't mean anything to them, they won't get in their way. And if it means everything to them, their religious roots will produce enough branches so that the branches will intertwine wonderfully. I think I mentioned Rabbi Heschel. He was a really profound Jew. I adored that man. He was my mentor. It never would have occurred to me to want to convert him any more than it would have occurred to him to convert me. My mother wasn't Jewish. But both of us had very profound roots, religious roots, Christian and Jewish, so that the branches that came forth from those roots just reached out to each other, you know, and intertwined in the most wonderful fashion. So if both people are profoundly religious, then I think it does work. The trouble comes when one of them, let's say, is very religious and the other isn't, and here comes Sunday morning, and let's say he wants to read the New York Times and stay home and enjoy a nice morning. And she said, no, I want to go to church, you know. And then the friction begins. How are the children going to be brought up? And then you use religion in a way which shouldn't be used because the real problem is between you and that sort of thing. But basically, I think we can handle interfaith. The main thing in marriage is that people share that which means most to them and have enormous amount of respect for each other. Now, if respect can be maintained and a capacity to share what means most, then you have a pretty good marriage, I think.
A lot of people are very obsessed with success now and with goal orientation and achieving their five-year plan and everything. And I wonder if you've ever been overtaken by that in any way within the world of the church, you know, and how you've dealt with your own sense of what you want to accomplish and what is success going to mean in the terms that you're going to define it for yourself.
I've had lots of problems in my life and lots of battles, but that's never been much of one. I was always pretty clear, I think, that justice and peace and things like that were areas where I felt a strong stand had to be taken. I do remember when I was at Yale, at one point in 1968, I was apparently the leading candidate to go to Riverside. And the head of the search committee came up to Yale to see me and told me so. And I knew that 2 weeks down the line, I would be accepting draft cards in the Arlington Street Church in Boston, and then a few days later be turning them into the Justice Department in Washington, for which I would, in all likelihood, get arrested, which is what happened. Spock and I and some others were arrested. And I did, for just the briefest of moments, stop to think that, gee, if I go ahead on these draft cards, they'll never invite me to Riverside. But it was the briefest of moments, I'm glad to report, because then it just came through very clearly to me, you do not conduct yourself in your present job according to your wishes for your future job. And so it ended just like that. And sure enough, they didn't invite me to Riverside, at least not for another 9 years. But that's never been, I guess, first of all, I guess it's pride, too. I mean, I have an image of myself, and I just couldn't bear to be. If I would have had an image of myself as somebody who sold out, somebody who could be bought, yeah, I just couldn't live with it. Secondly, I can't bear to be bored, and I think a lot of the people who live safe, sterile lives are bored to death. Who was it who said, if you do not share, Oliver Wendell Holmes, if you do not share in the action and passion of your times, you must count yourself as not having lived, something like that. And I think he was right. You know, it's my life at least has not been boring. And I know a lot of, quote, successful people who are really quite boring and certainly are bored.
That was Reverend William Sloan Coffin, author, activist, former Yale University chaplain, and now senior minister at New York's Riverside Church. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.